weapons by 2020. Since 2004, the U.S. Conference of Mayors has annually adopted resolutions in support of Mayors for Peace, which have been increasingly stronger. And so this year's resolution is building on the last few years, which have explicitly, since the economic crisis, have explicitly called for cutting nuclear weapons spending and redirecting funds to meet the urgent needs of cities. And also on a separate resolution they adopted in 2011 calling for an early end to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and the redirection of those funds to meet domestic needs. It has two sets of paragraphs, if you will. The first set calls on the president and the U.S. government to participate constructively in three different new international disarmament fora, which the U.S. has been boycotting. Secondly, it calls on the Congress, President and Congress, to terminate funding for modernization of nuclear weapons, to slash nuclear weapons spending to the minimum necessary to keep the existing weapons safe and until they're disabled and dismantled, and to redirect those funds to meet the urgent needs of cities, and also calls on President and Congress to substantially reduce military spending across the board and to reinvest those funds in programs to address domestic needs.
What is the value in making and putting forth these resolutions, both in terms of putting real pressure on the administration and Congress, and also in terms of the work of the Conference of Mayors itself?
The U.S. Conference of Mayors has a very active lobbying operation, and it is bipartisan. And the resolutions that are adopted on a whole host of issues at their annual conferences become official U.S. Conference of Mayors policy for the coming year. And the U.S. Conference of Mayors really is considered Main Street USA, so it's by no means a fringe operation. It's an important constituency for Congress. The resolution broadly provides an educational vehicle because it's very detailed in spelling out what the facts are and what's being called for, and it's being used by all kinds of peace and economic justice groups around the country to approach their mayors, to try to get their mayors to take a position, join Mayors for Peace, and to, you know, actually voice these demands. So it serves a number of different purposes.
Is there some mechanism or a website or some way for our listeners to be able to tap into this and to start their lobbying efforts in individual?
You can go to the website of Western States Legal Foundation, which is www.wslfweb.org. And under What's New at the top of the landing page, there's an action alert. There's a link to an action alert that spells it all out.
Mm-hmm. And is there a time frame that you're asking people to act within?
Yeah, people need to, we need to have our co-sponsors by the end of the day on the 20th of June, so it's just about a week and a half from now.
What's your sense of what the mayors feel they really need in place of all this spending on military and also this spending on nuclear arms?
Well, I have heard my mayor specifically talk about the endangerment of Head Start program for preschool children, the Section 8 housing vouchers, and Social Security and Medicare. And the community block development grants, very important to many cities. That's the federal funding pathway to cities. So all of those programs are endangered because of the budget sequester now. All cities need help maintaining their vital public services, teachers, police, firefighters, you know, after school programs, educational programs for at-risk youth, all those kind of things. And there's plenty of money. It's in the military. It's in nuclear weapons, you know. Mayor Bloomberg actually was lobbied and approached several times to join Mayors for Peace and did not. But I think really kind of egregiously, he declined to welcome and meet with the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2005 when they came to the UN. One of the things that they did was to lay a wreath at Ground Zero. So we around the country are disappointed in Mayor Bloomberg, especially because he's taken such a leading role in illegal guns.
You're not the only ones disappointed.
Right, and hopefully, so if I could say this to anybody who's in the New York metro area, hopefully your next mayor can be persuaded to join Mayors for Peace and get active.
Jackie Cabezo is National Coordinator of Mayors for Peace. She spoke with WBAI's Jose Santiago. Some of the news for Wednesday, June 12, 2013. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago and Rebecca Miles. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
Greetings all, and welcome tonight to this special memorial edition of Earthwatch on WBAI, dedicated to our late friend and colleague Ibrahim Gonzalez. Later in the program, we'll review some of the monumental issues underlying the recent whistleblower revelations about NSA spying on virtually all American citizens. But first, we note that WBAI is currently in the final round of our annual spring drive with an urgent need for your tax-deductible donations, which are the lifeline of this, your community radio station. And it is according to the express wishes of the Gonzalez family and the explicit admonition of Ibrahim's widow, Janet Norquist Gonzalez, that you are invited to make a memorial donation to WBAI, the station that Ibrahim so loved, with a call to our pledge line at 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. And now we pause momentarily to seek both sustenance for the station and great spirits to lift our lives. I'm Robert Knight, and this is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York. And the very next voice that you shall hear is that of one of Ibrahim's equally brilliant brothers, Alfred Gonzalez, speaking on Friday, June 7th, 2013, at Ibrahim's memorial service to a capacity crowd at the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood in Harlem. Thank you.
born on January 22nd, 1956, and his parents and mine were Carmen Gonzalez and Wilfredo Gonzalez. He was their only child for the first 6 years, six and a half years, and he was spoiled, believe it or not. If you see the pictures here, you'll see that Ibrahim had the finest clothes on. And obviously, later on in life, you saw him with the finest clothes. If we looked at Ibrahim, we think of an animal, it would be the peacock. It's very colorful, very beautiful, and flamboyant. Then we came, Frederick and Alfred, his twin brothers, breaking things. He wasn't happy. He told us this. He wasn't happy at all. We were all raised in El Barrio, which was where his soul always was, still is. Very involved in the community at a very young age. With his best friend Angelo, at a very early age, he started a publication called Resistencia. How many Spanish-speaking people do we have? And we have a couple of people from Spelman here. Resistencia in English means resistance. And he just, at a very early age, got involved in wanting to make a change, wanted to make a difference. Not for him, but for the community, for everyone who was willing to listen and hear. And he read a lot. And out of everything that he read, he shared with us, his brothers, of course. And one of the first things would have been the Quran. Because at 17 years old, Ibrahim decided that he wanted to convert. We didn't understand, but we understood much later, because the change was there. Ibrahim became a different person. And not that he was bad to begin with, but it just really catapulted who he was and what he believed in, and gave him the strength to carry out whatever he wanted to do. And so Ibrahim, as my brother Ricky said last night, is a nonconformist, and that's true in every sense of the word. So what he decided to do at a very young age was to learn. When we read things, I mean, we all read books, and some of those books are translated from other languages. Well, the Holy Quran originally was written in Arabic, if I'm not mistaken. And to get the true meaning of the Holy Quran, then it would be best to learn Arabic. And so he learned to read, write, and speak Arabic pretty much on his own. We sat with him many nights reading the Quran. We went to mosque praying side by side with some of you brothers here today. Sometimes we fell asleep, but he kept on reading.
That and was the mosque or church?
Both. And he would continue to read, and I know that even though we were sleeping, we were getting the message, and he knew that too. So what a lot of people don't know is that Ibrahim's given name was Freddy. I don't know how many people know that. Certainly his family does. His aunt still calls him Fredito. But that wasn't by my father's choice, not my mother's, I assure you, because there are four of us, and we're all called Fred. So starting with our oldest brother, Wilfred, Wilfredo Gonzalez. Then came the twins, then came Freddy, and the twins, Frederick and Alfred. So I guess take a shot at if we had a sister, what she would have been named. I don't know, but there are a number of combinations I'm sure he would have come up with. So my brother Ibrahim, I think that we've always considered to be a superhero. Not in the sense of what you might be thinking right now, because when we were very small, I remember being in the kitchen. And at home, the kitchen was a long corridor. And at one end of that kitchen was a garbage can with a lid about this big. Yahya might remember. And what he'd do is fling the lid at us, singing the Captain America phrase. So we'd be surprised from time to time. His superheroisms scared us sometimes. There was one time he had a cape on. And there were two doors at home that were adjacent to each other, and he wanted to jump from one room to the other room, but somebody forgot to tell him that there was a sill at the top of the door, and he hit his head. And he was in the hospital getting 4 or 5 stitches. Those of you who have seen him in his bald days, How many? I know the family, when he was bald, because he shaved his head, would have seen the scar up at the top of his head. I bring this up because Ibrahim, my mother was sort of saying, stop, you know, take it easy. Something's going to happen to you. And he just kept moving. And that element of scaring, and just because he wanted to make the difference in life for his family, for his community, of course, all of that involves risks. And so we spoke about him yesterday, and sure, he was expelled from Cardinal Spellman. The reason is, one of the reasons, he didn't want to cut his hair. And when they asked him why, he said, I want to be like him. And what do you say? There was Jesus Christ looking down. And so they didn't like that. They expelled him. Ibrahim in the 8th grade or 7th grade decided he didn't want to wear a uniform in this Catholic school anymore. And he came to school with his dark glasses and his dashiki and jeans. And I don't know, they couldn't handle it. My mother made many trips to the school, not for bad grades, but just because he wanted to make a difference and make people realize that there's something more than Metropolis, for those of you who have seen that film, Metropolis, which is a film that he took us to see when we were very young. So, of course, they took him to the office. Ibrahim, are you on drugs? You know, this was what they asked. They asked my mother, are you on drugs? No, I'm Puerto Rican. You know, my roots are from Africa and Taino and Spain. And so he organized a sit-out in the school in the 8th grade, where he organized about 30 students, 40 students, not to go to class. And they went out to lunch, but they didn't go back in. And a lot of the parents were not happy at picking up their kids at about 1 o'clock and taking them home. The next day, everybody was back in class, of course. This was my brother. This was your father, your uncle, your brother, to all of you. Just always causing havoc, mayhem, but moving forward. Ibrahim was many things, and in his journey, who he finally became influenced everybody around him. So this journey we all took with him. If I'm a photographer today, I owe it to him. If my brothers are musicians, and as Ricky said yesterday, we play chess, we owe it to him. If we love people and we want to help people, we owe that to him. Certainly my mother and my grandmother, but Ibrahim was one of the most influential people to us. I can remember my childhood hanging out in the village with him. My hair was down to here. I had a leather headband. Look a little different today. Farmer pants. He bought us flutes, so we would play in the park. For those of you who are in the days of the 1970s Central Park, when you walked in there, Yahya, where are you? The congas. You walk into the park, and so we learned to play the congas, and it was just constantly around art, constantly around music, constantly around people, constantly around Islam, constantly around. We went with Ibrahim to a Hare Krishna temple. This is him finding his way, but also learning from everyone else. And if you look at his name, Freddie, which was given to him, which he figures is just too common because three other brothers had Fred in their name. His first attempt at changing his name, he looked up his roots and his our great-grandfather's name, Ingenio. And so now you guys are going to call me Ingenio. And I'm like, okay. We never did. We didn't get used to it. He converted to Islam, and Ibrahim stuck. Ibrahim is a great name for the people who have chosen it as their Muslim name. Ibrahim, Abraham, father of all religions. Judaism, Islam, Christianity. We all know who he is. He's in all of our books, right? Mm-hmm. And so what a name that's so befitting, because Abraham was the patriarch of all time. And when we look at Ibrahim, I would just say that just the same, he's the patriarch for the family, for many. And yesterday, that was a true testament to how true these words are. And I really tried my best to shake everybody's hand who came and to greet them and then to ask them, how do you know my brother? And they said, well, we were working on this project 2 or 3 years ago, but he always kept in touch after that. And then he called his brothers every other day, his children. And then yesterday was today, Friday. 2 days ago, he was on his way to California. But before he was getting to California, he was going to visit his best friend, Angelo, in Denver. Angelo called me, was devastated, and he says, and I said, you know, we have something to learn here, and one of the things is that he left a lot behind, and if it's not documented on film, it's in our hearts, everything that he's taught all of us. Of course, Ibrahim wanted us to become Muslim, and I'm not so sure about my brother Ricky, and incidentally, we're all Muslim, and this is something he taught us also. Everybody in this room is Muslim. Because Muslim means submissive to God. This he taught us. But one day, Ricky and I were at a mosque, and there was an imam who shook Ricky's hand and gave him shahada as he was shaking his hand. Didn't give him a warning. His name is Farouk. This is a true story.
I think it was Sheikh Nazim.
Sheikh Nazim, peace be upon him. Shahada, for those of you who don't speak Arabic, is could you become a Muslim. That is it. It doesn't take long, does it?
No. Nope.
It just takes your wanting to be.
As long as a handshake.
It's a handshake. And so, Ricky, well,
wow.
Welcome to the brotherhood. So I learned through that and through many things that Muslims do have a great sense of humor. I mean, we grew up with Muslims in our lives. At home, there was no pork. We didn't eat pork at home. It was just my mom didn't cook pork for anybody because her son became Muslim, and she respected and saw how important that was to him. And that's the way she was with all of us. We had different religions at home, and her friends who were Catholics, and like, how do you live with 3 or 4 people in your home where all different religions? She says, we all believe in God. And just as long as they're here by my side and they're not on the street, as my brother Ricky said yesterday, they're fine. They can turn the house upside down, but they're here. And everybody was welcome to our home. One of the people that was welcome is Kenny, our Japanese brother. Kenny and I went to school and in college, and he says, I'm going back to Japan. I said, well, look me up sometime. And he says, well, come on out. I'm sorry I didn't take you up on that. I still haven't been. But then one day I get a phone call, and Kenny says, hey, I'm coming to New York to stay. Can I stay with you? And that stay was about 1.5 years. So my mother welcomed him, and he learned to eat pasteles, arroz con habichuela, gandules, and everything. And his son followed suit, and now they're native Puerto Ricans of El Barrio. So today's a beautiful day, and I like the fact that you point out it is raining, and rain is a good thing, and Ibrahim loved to walk in the rain. Ibrahim loved to walk in the sun. Ibrahim loved to walk in the snow. It didn't matter. He just loved to walk. Because it gave him a chance to spend with himself, with God, with nature, with Charlie. Every time he come to my house, one of the first things he and Jalila would do was take Charlie, our dog, out for a walk. And Charlie sends his regards. So, here it is. The things that I've learned, and I think we're going to end because I can take up another hour, but Allahu Akbar, God is great. One of the first things I learned from my brother. In any language, it means the same. As-salamu alaykum, as-salamu alaykum, brothers and sisters. Alaykum salam. Peace be upon you. Inshallah, God willing. Inshallah, if you look it up, it goes back to Spanish roots, and the Spanish people say, ojalá. If you didn't know, that means in God, ojalá. When you say ojalá, I'm like, I hope that this happens. Well, no, I'm asking God that this will happen. Muslim, of course, one who submits to God, which we're all Muslims. We might not call ourselves that, but if that's what the word means, then we are. Alhamdulillah, all praise to God. And when you look at the Arabic language, it's quite a beautiful one, because I've never seen or heard a language, and thanks to my brother, that a lot of the words contain the word, the name of God, Allah. So many words that Allah is within there, which means that He is always present in what you say, how you pray, and how you greet one another, and how you greet everybody. So, Allah called Ibrahim on Tuesday morning. And Ibrahim, as obedient as he was in life, obeyed the calling. And some of us say, rest in peace, and I hope that you are, at the right hand of the Father in so many different ways, but that's not the case, and we know that Ibrahim will continue to work from where he is to help others. Please, Ibrahim, don't try to change things wherever you are, because it's already set. It's a set. Now it's to just get there and adjust. But I know that from where he is, he will continue to try to help us change things through his inspiration, through his visits to us. And yesterday he was ever present among us. I'm sure he couldn't have been happier to give his blessing to those who came to see him as we gave our blessing to him. And if I've told so many people yesterday and in all the phone calls, thank you all so much, that, you know, you might have lost somebody great to you, but imagine growing up as a child with somebody like this, where the whole world was exposed to you. Sometimes too much of it was a lot. I mean, we were reading communist books when we were 8 years old.
The Red Book.
But we got an education, and we'll never forget it. And we know that that this moment in time for us as a family, his brothers, his daughters, his sons, his nieces and nephews, is a real turning point for all of us, in that the effort has to be made to remember who he was. And the only way to do that is to support one another. Jalila, you'll have us forever, of course, and to be there for one another, and to continue to carry on his legacy, that this is what he wanted, and his desire to help so many. Because yesterday, there were five people who told me that Ibrahim was going to meet with me this week to help me with this. I don't know how he was going to do it. He'll probably get to it now. It's a little easier, I think. But we're all grateful, I think, for having him in our lives. And Ibrahim is still our superhero, a superhero to many. And I thank God and Allah, well, same, one and the same, for having such an incredible brother, an incredible childhood, and for showing me that there's something more, and that if you want to make a change, change yourself first, and then help other people change. But if they resist, that is their choice. And he's always let us know that people have their own choices. I've made mine, now you make yours. So praise be to Allah. And thank you so much for your attention.
That was Alfred Gonzalez, brother of the late Ibrahim, speaking at his memorial service on June 7, 2013, at the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood in West Harlem. This is Earthwatch, and we have more. WBAI is presently in the midst of our Spring Fund Drive and is taking your tax-deductible donations at 516-620-3602. The navigation of this public radio station from tragedy to triumph was discussed recently with Christina Pagan on BronxNet Television in an interview featuring Public Affairs Director Kathy Davis and our late great colleague, Ibrahim Gonzalez.
Hello, viewers. I'm your host, Christina Pagan.
And remember, this is a live and interactive talk show. We want to encourage you to join in on the conversation by following our social media pages on Twitter, at BronxNetTV, and Facebook by going to facebook.com/OpenBronxNetTelevision. Not-for-profit public radio station 99.5 FM is at risk of shutting down, jeopardizing freedom of speech on the radio. The station has launched a campaign titled The Transmitter Fund in order to raise the money needed to pay the transmitter tower rent. Here to share more about the campaign and their upcoming event is Catherine Davis and Ibrahim Gonzalez. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having us.
Christina.
No problem. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about what WBAI stands for? What is their mission?
WBAI is a listener-supported radio station. It's approximately 52 years old that it was created, and it's part of the Pacifica network, which is about 10 years older. Pacifica was created by Lou Hill, who was a war pacifist in World War II, mm-hmm. and actually was jailed so as not to go to war. And he created this first one radio station. It became a network, and its purpose is to bridge the gap between understandings and bring people together of different belief systems, different races, different creeds, to be able to create peace across the world. Mm-hmm. And WBAI was created by a gentleman named Lou Schweitzer, who was also very much opposed to the impact of commercials on media and on the ability of media to report the true news. And he ultimately donated his station to Pacifica, and WBAI became part of the Pacifica network that has five stations: New York, Washington, D.C., Houston, Texas, Berkeley, California, and Los Angeles.
What kind of programming can we find on Pacifica here in New York?
Well, we have a mixture of public affairs, music, and something we call live radio, which is sort of like what you're doing, where it's eclectic and mixes music and conversation and the arts with public affairs. And we have a number of talk shows. We have Wake Up Call from at 6 to 8, and Democracy Now from 8 to 9, and then we have programs like Talk Back and 5 O'Clock Shadow, which are all politically based. And then we have a music strip in the morning, 10 to 12. We have music programs on the weekend, and the evenings and overnights it's more eclectic. But it's sort of a checkerboard of different kinds of programs. We have programs that focus on housing issues, on legal issues, mm-hmm. social justice, labor. So we really are, we call ourselves the, you know, the radio station for the 99%, and we cover those issues.
Indeed. So what's the problem now? What's going on with this transmitter? Where is it and why?
The transmitter is on top of the Empire State Building, mm-hmm. and we've had the transmitter there from the beginning, and the rents have escalated tremendously, and so we went from paying something in the neighborhood of $28,000-$30,000 a month. Now that's a lot.
That is a lot.
But now we're having to pay between $49,000 and $52,000 each month.
Wow.
For our transmitter. And it's important because we reach the whole city, all the boroughs, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania. It's a very broad audience that we can reach. And since the towers came down, the Empire State Building is kind of the only game in town. And so the rent has escalated.
They've taken advantage.
Well, yeah, they can. I guess they have the ability to do that. And we've also had the same kind of difficulty with our office address. We were at a Wall Street address. When we moved in, it was a building designed for nonprofit organizations. About midway through, it was purchased and converted into 50-50 commercial. And, you know, rents escalated very quickly there as well. And because we don't actually take corporate money at all, we only depend on the listeners, you know, the CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But those are really small donations that come to us. And times have been hard for everyone, so the donations haven't been where we needed them to be to keep scale with our escalating costs. So we've kind of been dragging behind us this debt that slowly built up.
Right.
And, you know, we'd pay on it regularly, but we could never quite catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And so we approached a point where sort of the roof fell in. And a lot of that was with Hurricane Sandy. And we were on Wall Street right by the water, the East River, and our building actually flooded almost to the third floor.
Wow.
And we've had no phone service since that time.
Oh my goodness.
So we've been struggling, but we're moving ahead, and we've moved the studios, sharing with City University in Harlem, and over by 137th Street, and then we have office space downtown. In it's a space that was offered to nonprofits because of Hurricane Sandy, so we have a few months reprieve, and so now we're at the point of needing to get current on all of these bills that have escalated and threatened to shut us down, really.
What kind of threshold are you looking at?
Well, we're looking to raise $500,000 by the end of the month. We're halfway there, so it's not, you know, it's not as tragic as it might have been. And so we've been paying really huge payments to the Empire State Building. We've made like a $50,000 payment, $120,000 payment, something like that. So we're making huge payments,
mm-hmm.
and we're also paying on our back rent to the tune of $30,000, $20,000. So it's like between now and August, I would say, that we have this period where we have to really catch up and raise enough money to keep the station broadcasting.
Oh, I understand you're having an event to help with that.
Yes, we are. We're having an event at SOBs, and Ibrahim will
Sounds
talk more
Brazil.
About that.
Yeah, the world-famous Sounds of Brazil at 405 Varick Street and the corner of West Houston. And we have several bands playing. We're going to have a band called Ibrahim Gonzalez and Y Amigos. And then also,
you're not in that, right?
I'm heading it front and center, and I'm, you know, back in the music business the way I want to be with this event. This has been my impetus to get back behind the congas. And Chico Alves and Mauricio Smith Jr. with their charanga band. Manuel Kendall's Libre, which is Bronx-based, originally from here, under the direction of Andy Gonzalez. And then we're also going to have another Bronx, a son of the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
We got SOBs playing at SOB. Bobby Sanabria and his Afro-Cuban jazz big band from the Manhattan School of Music. It's the first in a series of fundraisers that we're going to do off the air, because we can't just keep pitching on the air and asking for money. It impacts the programming in a way that it doesn't allow for the creative stuff to come through as much. But there's a phone number people can call. Could I give that out on the air?
Absolutely.
Put it up on the screen on the lower third. Okay, here we go. It's 516-620-3602. You can call there. And anybody that wants to make a contribution to the transmitter fund,
mm-hmm.
call that number to make a contribution to save our transmitter. Once the transmitter goes, there's no more radio station. It'll be taken off the map in terms of terrestrial radio. So everybody's pulling together, Kathy, myself, all of our colleagues at WBAI, our volunteers, people on the board of directors, on the local station board, and the Pacifica National. It's a big family, and we extend our invitation to the people of the Bronx and beyond to help us out on the cause.
Yes, we have a lot of members that reside in the Bronx, so I'm really happy to be able to be here to talk to them from your TV station. And they could actually come to our website as well,
mm-hmm.
WBAI.org. And not only will you see the various ways that you can support the station, and so it's a big community, and we hope to expand and flourish.
Mm-hmm. Other alternatives for you guys other than transmitting through the Empire State Building? I mean, in terms of like web broadcasting, things like that?
Well, we do broadcast on the internet. If you go to our website, WBAI.org, it streams. But there's something about having a radio broadcast. It's the only thing that's really free, that everyone can have access to in a way that maybe not everyone has a computer,
mm-hmm.
but people can get access to radio. And it also gives us a tremendous local power. So the internet is important when you want to reach across the globe. But we're a New York station,
mm-hmm.
and we bring in people from the community, and we cover the issues that are taking place in the Bronx and in Queens and in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very live station, and I think it's important to have that terrestrial radio experience. It's a very different kind of experience than internet radio. because much of it is live.
And let me piggyback with the fact that the large media conglomerations have swallowed up a lot of the frequencies from coast to coast, and we're one of the few standing non-commercial radio stations, especially here in New York, where 99.5 FM is right in the middle of the dial, to the left of us and to the right of us, nothing but commercial radio.
Right. Very popular stations, too.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, very competitive, and they do what they do well, but we do what we do. And we represent community and a different paradigm for communication here in New York City.
All right. Can you give us that number again for...
Sure. The number to call in for donations for the Transmitter Fund is 516-620-3602.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Do you have any other things you want to say? How can people, like, get involved in terms of being with the radio, working at the radio?
Well, they should go to the website, wbai.org, because we do have interns, and we have people who come in and get involved with the station. We need a lot of volunteers. Most of our producers are actually, you know, unpaid volunteer producers. So I would say 98% of the producers who have regular programs are volunteers. And so that would be the thing to do, to go to the website and get in contact with us and find out how you can get involved in producing radio.
Great. Thank you so much, guys, for joining me.
Kathy Davis and the late Ibrahim Gonzalez recently speaking with Christina Pagan about WBAI on BronxNet TV. On the evening of June 3, 2013, our dear friend and WBAI colleague Ibrahim Gonzalez passed away at home in his sleep. Ibrahim was known both personally and institutionally as the Mambo Dervish, based on his skill as a bandleader and conga player, and for his devotion to Sufi Islam. Ibrahim was a co-founder in 1975 of the Alianza Islamica, the nation's oldest national organization for Latino Muslims, which was then based in his childhood community of East Harlem, before moving to Mott Haven in Ibrahim's beloved Bronx. Although he was first reared as a Catholic, he said that he was not so much converted as he was reverted to Sufi Islam. Ibrahim said of the Islamic Alliance that, quote, "Islam represented a place for us to be part of a larger community when we realized that within Islam there was every spectrum of people, regardless of class, regardless of race. We were attracted to that universal principle of human interaction and communion with the divine," end quote. But the organization's commitment to nonviolence did not immunize Ibrahim from a 1994 visit from FBI agents, whom Ibrahim characterized as, quote, "looking for terrorists," end quote. However, the most explosive element of Ibrahim's life was his dynamic mastery of the conga drums, through which he has composed for symphonies and led his own eponymous orchestra and quintet, as well as the Nuyorican Jazz Experience, among innumerable projects and performances celebrating the Afro-Caribbean and Latin rhythms of salsa and Nuyorican culture. Ibrahim recently headlined a WBAI benefit at the world-famous SOBs and has appeared at the Bronx Museum and many other venues. Ibrahim, always nattily dressed in such trademark outfits as bow ties, suspenders, fedoras, Panama hats, and linen suits, was ubiquitous as the smiling center of a whirlwind of music, daily incarnating his legend as the Mambo Dervish. But Ibrahim's gifts were so bountiful that not even music could contain them all. He was a highly accomplished still photographer, mastering the artistically demanding film discipline of the twin lens reflex, in addition to modern digital media, including his talent as a professional videographer and television reporter and documentarian. Those skills earned him on-air work at BronxNet Television, where he consistently reported on people and things that matter in the preservation of New York City's polymorphic culture. Here at WBAI, Ibrahim's gentle dialogues and grasp of global affairs earned him his highly acclaimed airtime on such programs as Wake Up Call, Radio Libre, and his mystical morning show, In the Moment, which he described as, quote, "a spontaneous mix of eclectic sounds, interviews, and live performance," end quote. Prior to his arrival at WBAI, Ibrahim was also featured on the broadcasts of our current studio hosts, WHCR, Harlem Community Radio. This Renaissance man also taught piano, composition, digital audio production, and the history of Latin Caribbean music at our own alma mater, Manhattan College in Riverdale, and throughout the New York City school system. Ibrahim Gonzalez is survived by 4 brothers, 5 children, and 11 grandchildren, numerous nephews and nieces, and other relatives located in New York, California, Puerto Rico, Africa, and elsewhere, as well as his loving wife, Janet Norquist Gonzalez, an educator and award-winning cartographer. On a personal note, your reporter recalls the time late last year when he was hospitalized in his own near-death crisis, the complete recovery from which was aided in no small part by the bedside presence of beloved friend Ibrahim Gonzalez, who on several occasions roused him from his propofol stupor into the redemptive joy of hearing Ibrahim read aloud his favorite science fiction novel from an edition too heavy at the time for the then weakened and unsteady hands of your reporter. Ibrahim's healing instincts also extended to his beloved WBAI, where, with staff and management initiatives and your kind contributions, we together move to a higher state of institutional health. Among Ibrahim's most recent messages to your reporter was this: "I just want to help," end quote. Ibrahim Gonzalez, a mambo dervish whose whirlwind was as big as the world itself. If you, too, would like to help WBAI survive, please consider making a tax-deductible donation at this time with a call to our Pledge Center on behalf of the station so loved by our late, great friend and colleague, Ibrahim Gonzalez. The number is 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Meanwhile, we now hear Ibrahim Gonzalez in his own words.
Growing up in Spanish Harlem was an incredible experience because I heard music everywhere in the neighborhood. Me spinning around in my uncle's living room, who had a stereo hi-fi system and played the music of the greats, the music of Cal Jader, the music of Mongo Santa Maria, and the big three, Machito, Tito Puente, and Tito Rodriguez. My grandmother, both my parents, a lot of our relatives, they were all music lovers. They would get together at family gatherings, sing songs, play music on the record player. And parties may not have been something that we did every weekend, but when my family threw a party, boy, they really didn't know how to celebrate. Anda. And growing up in a family that had appreciation for our culture, our Puerto Rican roots, really planted the seeds for what I was later to become very proud of and very taken to, which is our music. Conga drum is one of the fundamental instruments in Latin music, and Latin music wouldn't be what it is without it. That is happening with Latin music is that it's undergoing various transformations. I would say that reggaeton is the more recent manifestation of a new movement within the Caribbean-based rhythm. That kind of rhythm in reggaeton is definitely Caribbean-based. It's a windy night in the Bronx, but I'm having a good time because I found one of my old-time favorite vinyl records. It's an LP, a long playing. It goes at 33 and a third revolutions per minute. Revolution, you know what I'm saying? All power to the people of the Bronx, of course. And Chubby Checker, I don't know if he was from the Bronx, but he sure used to love to dance. And as a kid, I would be dancing the whole day to this particular record. So I'm going to slide it out of the cover. Got some nice liner notes there. Carefully placed the vinyl record on the turntable. And got to find the spindle, right? So there you go. You got to be very careful how you place the tone arm on the record, because you never want to scratch your record. So there it goes, 33 and a third revolutions per minute. Take the tone arm, be very careful, drop the stylus on the record, and let it play. You have to dance if you want to be part of my revolution. The more I read poetry, the more interested I became in writing poetry of my own and making my own individual statement. This is a story from a long time ago. 700 or 800 years have passed or so. A time of knights in shining armor. Medieval times we set out to honor. The poetic music of storytellers from door to door. Artistic, theatrical, the troubadour. Then in Spain, there were many folk. Arab, Visigoth, Celt, and Jew. Roman, Berber, Frank, and Gypsy, they all knew that gold and riches belonged but to a few. The rest, with love, daily bread, and some stew, some song and dance, they all made do. From town to town, they would wander, telling tales of over yonder, to young and old, rich and poor, these stories, till today, endure. Poems of romance, facing danger with no chance, legends of heroes throughout the land, bravery and wit worked hand in hand, never fancied the people of these quarters, civilized people lived across Atlantic waters. On ventured the Mandinga of Africa, on canoes, after which on Pinta, Nina, and Santa Maria, sailed you know who. Upon arriving the shores of Quisqueya, they found people, Taino, Caribe, all around. They lived in harmony with their enchanted tropic, though still today an unknown topic. Then greed and slaughter were to follow, a dark beginning of much sorrow. In the long run, peace and harmony won out. Life became better without a doubt, and Jíbaro from the hills would shout, Viva Puerto Rico Libre! Standing proudly and stout. The Taino his maracas would shake, all pure and good spirits to awake. The Spaniard of old land would sing and strum, the African of his ancestors libate and drum. Troubadours of a new breed were they, from pueblo to pueblo spreading news day by day. Jíbaros, guajiros, a culture, a new way, fresh birth of expression, come what may. So these are the people we speak of now, who sang their song, pushed their plow. They give thanks daily and work the land, and by night organize their merry band. On cuatros, guitarras, güiros, tambores, they perform. On wood, ceramic, and canvas adorn. Art for all, and all for art. Now, you and I can do our part. Radio, as you know, is a very oral medium.
you always have to have something to say on the radio, one way or the other. Whether you say it by hiding behind the music that you play and piecing it together in just the right type of combination of sequence and mix and mood and color, or if you get on the mic and you start riffing and start talking to the audience.
Buenos días, buenos días. Señor Ibrahim.
Buenos días. Sí. A su servicio.
I love hearing you when it's Latin time, and it's lovely hearing you in the morning.
I love hearing you right now.
A little rest, but you can understand why, you know, just waking up and all. But, you know, I'd like to remind people that Bob Fast was on at a time when listening to certain stations was almost going against the government, and saying certain things was could get you killed. Now, things ain't changed that much, okay? And we should count our blessings with WBAI every day. Every single day. Dios te bendiga, cariño.
Gracias, igualmente. Que Dios me la haga santa. Wow, okay, well that's... I can take that to the bank, okay? I don't need any money after that call.
But one thing that does keep me in that type of mode of taking calls on the air is the spontaneity of it all. How I could open myself and how I can open up the airwaves to people's feelings, to their thoughts, to their concerns. And that's Freeform Radio.
Mario Murillo is in the studio. I want to thank everybody. This is Ibrahim Gonzalez. This has been In the Moment. Thank you so much for all of the calls, really, all of them. And what I want to say is that we'll be back, inshallah, next week, same place, 3:30 to 6 on In the Moment. I'm on this Sunday on the Barrio Block as well. Check us out from 2 to 4. And stay tuned for Wake Up Call con mi hermano y amigo, Mario Murillo. And as we say in the Bronx, cógelo con take it easy. Assalamu alaikum.
I am a child of the 60s, and I'm a citizen of the world, and also I'm a creative person into the 21st century. Creative cinema has always grabbed my attention because it goes beyond the bounds of, okay, here's the beginning, here's the body of the work, and then there's a conclusion, and everybody lives happily ever after.
Salsero, vamos a ver.
I know people have a certain expectancy level when they watch a film or when they see a television program, and they want to feel good at the end of it. But what I would like to do is go beyond just the kind of like just feel good, just kind of being nice to the audience. I want the audience to work with me. I want them to consider the things that I'm presenting. I would also like to work at it myself so that I get to another place. I get to a totally different place with whatever it is that I either write or spontaneously produce and put out there into the ether.
The late, great Ibrahim Gonzalez, may he rest in peace. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we turn now to the continuity and the expansion of domestic surveillance under the Obama administration, whose new motto is, Yes, We Scan. There's been a deluge of revelations about massive espionage and monitoring of virtually all Americans' electronic transactions. To help put this in context, we're now joined by Shahid Buttar, the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Welcome back to the show, Shahid.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, first of all, let's just do a seriatim review of some of the recent revelations, starting with the Verizon Business turnover of documents regarding the online and telephonic data of millions of American phone calls. There are two things that worry me about this report. Number one, would it not be naive to assume that Verizon is the only company involved in such things? And number two, there is reporting of so-called metadata, but anybody who knows anything about security or marketing knows that you can take one database and match it with another. And if you know the phone number, you know what company, and then you know what subscriber, and then you know the credit cards. And even if you don't have credit cards and they pay in cash, then you do have the surveillance cameras that can be up for review. So is this thing they call metadata really anonymized?
Not anonymized at all, and nor is Verizon the only telecommunications company doing this. All of the telecommunications companies are doing this, and one reason why is because in 2008, Congress passed a law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, with then-Senator Barack Obama's support, that immunized companies for violating the constitutional rights of Americans and facilitating precisely this kind of dragnet surveillance. And a lot of us made a big deal at the time, lost that struggle, and it basically gave the companies the legal cover to do whatever they want to us. And that's sort of what they've been doing since. And again, it's not just Verizon. On the issue about anonymity, you can tell a lot from metadata. Metadata people think about is the information on the envelope, right? It's who a call was addressed to, who it was from, how long it lasted. You can tell almost, in some respects, you can tell more from metadata than you can from content. You know, from the content of communications, you learn what people say or what they articulate. But from metadata, you can map social networks. You know who talks to whom, how often, for how long. That's much more useful from an intelligence standpoint, and it's also much more useful from a suppression standpoint, because that metadata can be used to map social networks. And let's just, you know, draw out an example. You know, the next time there is a movement like Occupy, which was forcibly suppressed by the state through infiltration, surveillance, outright police violence, the next time there's a movement like that, the NSA will have the tools to basically reconstruct everyone who was involved from the beginning. And that's exactly why we have historically refused to accept powers like this, because in a free society, governments should not be spying on their people. And in fact, if a government spies on its own people without basis en masse, that is exactly one of the reasons to describe a society as not free. And unfortunately, that describes the United States today. There has never been a country in the history of humankind, including the former Soviet Union, including the former East Germany, to which its subjects were more monitored than we in the United States today. The only possible exception to that is contemporary China. And so the next time, you know, your listeners find themselves singing about the land of the free and the home of the brave, it might be useful to reflect that America is unfortunately neither of those things.
One of the issues is the degree to which private information is being turned over to state agencies, whether it be the National Security Administration, whether it be the FBI, CIA, and all of the other alphabets whose names may be unknown to us even at this point in time. Does this not raise a question about the collusion between business and government, and are there equally significant threats from the use of privatized information in addition to state-operated information?
Great question, and it's absolutely true that more or less anything one discloses to a private sector, either corporation or company, is available to the government. That's a safe assumption to make. With the possible exception, there are some private sector actors that, like Twitter, for instance, that are very assertive about denying government access to their records. Those companies, though, are few and far between. It's not just the telecommunications companies. Fusion centers, for instance, around the country include neighborhood grocery stores. And this will sound ridiculous, but it's actually reflects an analysis by the NYPD in 2007, which recommended at the time tracking sales of falafel to identify who would be a likely terrorist. So presumably grocery stores around the country are providing the government with information about who's buying what kind of food. And it is ridiculous. It is preposterous. It can't keep us safe. It is offensive. And it's all been done in secret. And so that issue about the corporate public-private collusion is absolutely worth paying attention to. Just note, I happened to be in New York yesterday to speak at the Left Forum, and the context of my remarks was on a panel assessing to what extent the United States is in a pre-fascist state today. And the collusion of corporations and government is one of the central elements of fascism. In addition to controlled media, which we, you know, you can see that demonstrated in lots of ways, whether it's the crackdown on the whistleblowers that the Obama administration is centrally responsible for, or the assault on the Associated Press that came straight from the Justice Department. You know, a lot of elements that we have seen in the world before are unfortunately recurring, and the collusion between the public and private sector is absolutely at the crux of those very disturbing trends that we see in America today.
One of the revelations that came forward recently is the announcement of the so-called PRISM, P-R-I-S-M program of the National Security Administration or the National Security Agency. And that purports that a dozen or perhaps more, some accounts say as many as 50 corporations are turning over information to the government. What is your assessment of the importance of PRISM? And is that related to other dragnets that we might have heard of, like Carnivore with the FBI or Total Information Awareness with John Poindexter?
I think the latter is where to really draw the comparison. Total Information Awareness was a Pentagon aspiration presented to Congress in 2003, I believe, and it was ultimately defunded in 2004, or it might have been presented in 2002 and then defunded in 2003. Point here was that Congress affirmatively rejected the proposal to vacuum up all known sources of information to try to compile mosaics of whatever information the intelligence apparatus might need. That was a rejection by Congress, the one time it's actually stood up to do anything useful in this arena in the last decade. Well, Total Information Awareness has been built piecemeal by a litany of individual programs. You mentioned the Carnivore database, which the FBI uses. That's one tip of an iceberg. The PRISM program that the NSA is running to basically hack the back ends of corporate websites, that's another tip of the iceberg. Each of the disclosures that we've seen, for instance, the Section 215 order by the FISA court relating to Verizon, just the tip of an iceberg. And the iceberg is essentially what Total Information Awareness aimed to establish, which was information omniscience for the state. And when you think about information omniscience for the state in the face of state secrecy impeding the transparency into the state's activities on which a democratic society is based, we see absolutely the creation of tools that could easily be bent to authoritarian uses. And even if your listeners or anyone else is inclined to think that the Obama administration is benevolent, there is no reason to presume that every future administration will be. And these kinds of tools are dangerous and un-American because they could be abused. And that is a reason why, historically, courts have been very assertive in blocking these kinds of executive aggrandizing programs. And the mere fact that the corporate Supreme Court has, like the corporate Congress, washed its hands of the need to actually defend the Constitution should not leave the rest of us in the country so disinclined to defend our rights as to not recognize the plain, egregious, and escalating scandal outrage in plain sight.
Well, much like metadata, the term benevolent is one that's open to discussion because, after all, it is the Obama administration that is blaming the beginning of some of these things on the Bush administration, and yet it is Obama who put twice as many troops in Afghanistan than George Bush, who tremendously escalated the drone murders from remote control, and who has prosecuted whistleblowers at a far greater degree than any other president.
Absolutely. And the whistleblowers piece is especially critical in the context of this week's events and the news cycles recently. The only reason we know about the PRISM program, the only reason we know about the FISA court order, you know, authorizing blanket surveillance of Verizon customers, the only reason we know about the boundless informant program, the only reason we know about any of this stuff is that people resigned their careers to disclose to the American people government secrets that we ought to know. And those people have been prosecuted by the Obama administration at an unprecedented rate in our society. More whistleblowers in the national security arena have faced prosecution in the last 5 years than in the entire preceding 225-year history of our republic. The combined 225-year history, it's preposterous, and this by an administration, of course, that claims to be the most transparent ever and has even won awards for its transparency, ironically, in closed sessions. So, you know, all of the rhetoric about transparency is just that. It is rhetoric, and it flies in bald violation of the reality on the ground, and that is that whistleblowers are absolutely at risk. And here's the point I want to make. If we, the people, are interested in seeing what else remains of the iceberg, we keep getting these glimpses of just particular programs that peek above the surface because somebody somewhere released the documents to a reporter. If we want to know the rest, we need protections for whistleblowers. And it's ironic and particularly poignant, I think, that just last year, Congress and the president approved new whistleblower protections while including huge carve-outs for national security so that national security whistleblowers remain at risk of vindictive, predatory, self-interested, I dare say corrupt prosecution for performing what is ultimately a public service.
In regard to corrupt prosecution or malicious prosecution or ex post facto prosecution, one of the things the Obama administration is claiming is that, quote, no one is listening to people's phone calls. But isn't that a malicious slicing of words in as much as it is possible, even plausible or probable, that if phone calls are being recorded, that they can be submitted to speech-to-text conversions and they can be, quote, read instead of, quote, listened to?
Absolutely. And I think what they're basically trying to hide behind is the idea that the government doesn't have the capacity to listen to everyone's phone calls. But here's what it has the capacity to do: record them all, archive them, store them, and then at any point in the future when they might want to zoom in on any one of us, recall them and either, you know, read them in the way that you described or listen to them outright. It is absolutely the case that people's phone calls are being listened to. They're just not being listened to in real time. And the thin thread or stellar wind programs were good examples of ways in which the NSA, the National Security Agency, has attempted to, and from what I understand from the government whistleblowers, successfully enabled the piecing together of isolated communications by a particular individual across time. So, for instance, you know, these programs have been running for a decade. The NSA can essentially reconstruct everything that you have said or have heard in the last 10 years as long as it wasn't done in person. If somebody called you, if they messaged you, if they sent you a Facebook message, whatever it is, they can figure out everything that you've heard or been told. Now, the canard about metadata refers to that particular order, the FISA court order allowing the transactional records of Verizon customers to be collected by the NSA. The NSA has other programs. That's not the only one running. And the warrantless wiretapping program authorized in the 2008 FISA Amendments Act, another piece of the iceberg related to but different from the disclosures that we've seen in the last few weeks, that absolutely captures content. There's no question that they're capturing content. We just don't have the smoking gun evidence of it because there haven't been any whistleblowers who have risked prosecution to reveal that particular part of the iceberg to the public.
One of the things that I'm sure you're familiar with, Shahid Buttar, is the term the tyranny of the majority. But I suspect there is also a tyranny of bipartisanship in America today, in which members of the intelligence committees and members of Congress are breaking each other's legs to get out front saying that this is a good program, and they're using this hypnotic word, terrorism, for what are already defined to be crimes. So how does one assess the utility of Congress in protecting the Bill of Rights and the legitimacy of the FISA courts, for that matter, which, if I understand correctly, hear only a government advocate for espionage?
Great question, and it's a deep question, inviting a lot of different angles of reflection. So I'll just isolate Congress and the secret FISA court. Congress is an utter failure, and we absolutely have witnessed the collusion across two corporate political parties to denigrate and lay waste to the constitutional rights of we the American people. And if this creates a legitimacy crisis for a political establishment across two political parties, I dare say that is the best potential outcome of this scenario, because it ranges well beyond this discrete policy area, right? I mean, corporations run our country, and it is because corporations make so much money off of the surveillance programs and that they've been immunized from constitutional abuses and that those abuses go on in secret that we have been subjected to this very disturbing authoritarian set of violations over the last several years. And you can't find anyone in Congress to speak truth to that power. There are a handful, Senator Wyden from Oregon, Senator Paul from Kentucky, a handful of others, but they're few and far between. And the fact of the matter is that the leadership of both the Democratic and Republican parties are bought into these abuses. It's preposterous. I mean, they are all complicit in these issues. And I do think that the heads of the intelligence committees in particular really need to be replaced because they have gravely failed their responsibility to the American people. With respect to the FISA court, you know, any secret court is not actually a court. The judicial function, the idea of law, is predicated on the idea that subsequent courts can evaluate prior cases and compare those cases on the facts to see whether and to what extent the facts are the same, whether or not the same rules should apply. But when the decisions are secret, that can't happen. And so the secret FISA court has basically become a rubber stamp. And as members of Congress have proposed to proliferate secret courts to govern not only warrantless wiretapping, but also the use of drones to kill Americans abroad, that should send chills down our spine, because secret courts don't check and balance executive abuses. They rubber stamp them. And we can see that very clearly in the FISA court order disclosed to The Guardian last week. You know, there's no conceivable way that a real judge would authorize the blanket dragnet surveillance of millions of people because there's no showing of individualized suspicion. And that's exactly what the Constitution has long required for any government intrusion into information and collecting information about people. So there's no way to square the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment in particular with these abuses, and there's no way to square secrecy with courts. If it's secret, it's not a court anymore.
A final question for you on behalf of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Shahid Buttar. It seems that this puts a chilling effect on at least two amendments of the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment, as you mentioned, which guarantees the right of reasonable security and privacy, and the First Amendment, which also guarantees freedom of association, which could be sabotaged, misled, or even more proactively impeded. What does this mean for American freedom in regard to the Bill of Rights?
It means that we can't actually claim to be free. And I'd maybe take the point a little further. These programs frontally violate the Fourth Amendment, which is to say the Fourth Amendment is, as long as these programs persist, dead. It does not have current meaning in any meaningful way. Same with the Fifth Amendment, which is due process. Both of those have basically been written out of the Constitution. The First Amendment is where the chilling effect comes in, and it's because a lot of people will be a lot less reticent to engage the next social movement when they know that the military is tracking them. Right? And that shouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. The founders of our country knew it. That's why we have a First Amendment in the first place. But, you know, members of Congress today are either too, you know, uninformed or too co-opted to recognize that. It's astounding to me that even the courts don't recognize that. And it's even more preposterous to me that President Obama, despite being a constitutional scholar, doesn't recognize that. You know, we are toying with very fundamental elements of our society. And, you know, if we were to live in an authoritarian dictatorship, it's not like someone's going to wake up one day and vote for, okay, I'm going to check the authoritarian box. This is how democracies die, by a thousand cuts. And this is not merely a paper cut. This is like hacking off an arm. And our democracy is bleeding gravely from multiple wounds, whether it's the pervasive spying that the NSA is conducting, whether it's the FBI infiltrating mosques and activist groups, whether it's the authority to detain Americans without trial or kill them without trial based on what they say, which is by this point well established, or whether it's the authority to torture with impunity. Now, our democracy is bleeding from so many places that I do think it is past time to question whether or not we actually live in a democracy. I don't think America is even part of the free world anymore, let alone its leader. And we have allowed the transformation of our society through multiple piecemeal, discrete laws, and it is absolutely long overdue that those of us who care about freedom and liberty and living in a democracy force Congress, the courts, the White House, and the press to finally shift the discussion of these issues and restore the principles that have long made the United States a beacon of hope and freedom to people around the world.
Excellent. And perhaps next time we'll discuss posse comitatus as well.
Let's do it. And I would love also, you know, next time to discuss with your listeners ways that they can get involved, because I think ultimately that's the crux.
Well, tell people what you do at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and how they can be involved in preserving, protecting, and defending their constitutional rights.
Absolutely. What we do at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee is work with grassroots communities to build diverse coalitions around the country to politicize these issues, not just in Washington, but in Mayberry, in Springfield, in all the small towns across America, to challenge these abuses as they relate to local police. which are absolutely engaged in many of these same efforts. In New York City, we are a supporting member of the Communities United for Police Reform Coalition, and it's worth noting that the NYPD, much like the NSA, had a secret surveillance program that it took intrepid reporters to uncover, and those were reporters at the Associated Press who won a Pulitzer for their work. The NYPD's surveillance program can be restrained not just by Congress, but by the city council. And so the work we do at BORDC is helping mount resistance at all layers of our society. And anybody, any of your listeners can get involved in that work. We're happy to connect people to Communities United for Police Reform or to work with you wherever else you might live. Please drop us a line at organizing@BORDC, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, BORDC.org.
Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, thank you so much for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thanks so much for having me on, Robert. Keep up the great work.
In the abstract, you can complain about Big Brother and how this is a potential program run amok. But when you actually look at the details, then I think we've struck the right balance.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you're about to enter, so help you God.
I do.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And that was President Barack Obama defending his expansion of the surveillance state in America, followed by the oath of office given to Congress and officers of the Central Intelligence Agency, such as Edward Snowden, who revealed his identity as the NSA whistleblower overnight. We now hear, courtesy of The Guardian, Snowden, in his own words, speaking with investigative reporter Glenn Greenwald.
My name is Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii.
What are some of the positions that you held previously within the intelligence community?
I've been a systems engineer, systems administrator, senior advisor for the Central Intelligence Agency, solutions consultant, and a telecommunications information systems officer.
One of the things people are going to be most interested in trying to understand who you are and what you're thinking is there came some point in time when you crossed this line of thinking about being a whistleblower to making the choice to actually become a whistleblower. Walk people through that decision-making process.
When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee. And because of that, you see things that may be disturbing, but over the course of a normal person's career, you'd only see one or two of these instances. When you see everything, you see them on a more frequent basis. And you recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. And when you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them. But over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem. Until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
Talk a little bit about how the American surveillance state actually functions. Does it target the actions of Americans?
NSA and the intelligence community in general is focused on getting intelligence wherever it can, by any means possible, that it believes on the grounds of sort of a self-certification that they serve the national interest. Originally, we saw that focus very narrowly tailored as foreign intelligence gathered overseas. Now, increasingly, we see that it's happening domestically. And to do that, the NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them for periods of time, simply because that's the easiest, most efficient, and most valuable way to achieve these ends. So while they may be intending to target someone associated with a foreign government or someone that they suspect of terrorism, they're collecting your communications to do so. Any analyst at any time can target anyone, any selector anywhere. Where those communications will be picked up depends on the range of the sensor networks and the authorities that that analyst is empowered with. Not all analysts have the ability to target everything, but I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
One of the extraordinary parts about this episode is that usually whistleblowers do what they do anonymously and take steps to remain anonymous for as long as they can, which they hope often is forever. You, on the other hand, have decided to do the opposite, which is to declare yourself openly as the person behind these disclosures. Why did you choose to do that?
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures that are outside of the democratic model. When you are subverting the power of government, that's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy. And if you do that in secret consistently, you know, as the government does when it wants to benefit from a secret action that it took, it'll kind of give its officials a mandate to go, hey, you know, tell the press about this thing and that thing, so the public is on our side. But they rarely, if ever, do that when an abuse occurs. That falls to individual citizens, but they're typically maligned. You know, it becomes a thing of these people are against the country, they're against the government, but I'm not. I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
Have you given thought to what it is that the U.S. government's response to your conduct is in terms of what they might say about you, how they might try to depict you, what they might try to do to you?
Yeah, I could be, you know, rendered by the CIA. I could have people come after me or any of their third-party partners. You know, they work closely with a number of other nations. Or, you know, they could pay off the triads or, you know, any of their agents or assets. We've got a CIA station just up the road in the consulate here in Hong Kong. And I'm sure they're going to be very busy for the next week. And that's a fear I'll live under for the rest of my life, however long that happens to be. You can't come forward against the world's most powerful intelligence agencies and be completely free from risk, because they're such powerful adversaries that no one can meaningfully oppose them. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. But at the same time, you have to make a determination about what it is that's important to you. And if living unfreely but comfortably is something you're willing to accept, and I think many of us are, it's the human nature, you can get up every day, you can go to work, you can collect your large paycheck for relatively little work against the public interest and go to sleep at night after watching your shows. But if you realize that that's the world that you helped create, and it's going to get worse with the next generation and the next generation who extend the capabilities of this sort of architecture of oppression, you realize that you might be willing to accept any risk, and it doesn't matter what the outcome is, so long as the public gets to make their own decisions about how that's applied.
Why should people care about surveillance?
Because even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded, and the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude, to where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call, and then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with, and attack you on that basis, to sort of derive suspicion from an innocent life and paint anyone in the context of a wrongdoer.
We are currently sitting in a room in Hong Kong, which is where we are because you traveled here. Talk a little bit about why it is that you came here. And specifically, there are going to be people who will speculate that what you really intend to do is to defect to the country that many see as the number one rival of the United States, which is China, and that what you're really doing is essentially seeking to aid an enemy of the United States with which you intend to seek asylum. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's a couple assertions in those arguments that are sort of embedded in the questioning of the choice of Hong Kong. The first is that China is an enemy of the United States. It's not. I mean, there are conflicts between the United States government and the Chinese PRC government, but the peoples inherently, you know, we don't care. We trade with each other freely. You know, we're not at war. We're not in armed conflict, and we're not trying to be. We're the largest trading partners out there for each other. Additionally, Hong Kong has a strong tradition of free speech. People think, oh, China, great firewall. Mainland China does have significant restrictions on free speech, but the people of Hong Kong have a long tradition of protesting in the streets, of making their views known. The internet is not filtered here, no more so than any other Western government. And I believe that the Hong Kong government is actually independent in relation to a lot of other leading Western governments.
If your motive had been to harm the United States and help its enemies, or if your motive had been personal material gain, were there things that you could have done with these documents to advance those goals that you didn't end up doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anybody in the positions of access with the technical capabilities that I had could, you know, suck out secrets, pass them on the open market to Russia. You know, they always have an open door, as we do. I had access to, you know, the full rosters of everyone working at the NSA, the entire intelligence community, and undercover assets all around the world, the locations of every station we have, what their missions are, and so forth. If I had just wanted to harm the U.S., you know, that you could shut down the surveillance system in an afternoon, but that's not my intention. And I think for anyone making that argument, they need to think, if they were in my position, and you know, you live a privileged life, you're living in Hawaii in paradise and making a ton of money, what would it take to make you leave everything behind? The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. People will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the lengths that the government is going to grant themselves powers unilaterally to create greater control over American society and global society. But they won't be willing to take the risks necessarily to stand up and fight to change things, to force their representatives to actually take a stand in their interests. And the months ahead, the years ahead, it's only going to get worse until eventually there will be a time where policies will change, because the only thing that restricts the activities of the surveillance state are policy. Even our agreements with other sovereign governments, we consider that to be a stipulation of policy rather than a stipulation of law. And because of that, a new leader will be elected. They'll flip the switch, say that because of the crisis, because of the dangers that we face in the world, you know, some new and unpredicted threat, we need more authority. We need more power. And there will be nothing the people can do at that point to oppose it. And it'll be turnkey tyranny.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. And that concludes tonight's edition of Earthwatch. We welcome your comments with an email to rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight. Greetings all, and welcome tonight to this special memorial edition of Earthwatch on WBAI. dedicated to our late friend, Ibrahim Gonzalez. Later in the program, we'll review some of the monumental issues underlying the recent whistleblower revelations about NSA spying on virtually all American citizens. But first, we note that...
Good morning. Believe it or not, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, off the air for so long, and he's forgotten everything after all these years. Well, we have a regular Hour of the Wolf this morning, and it's going to be a tribute to the great writer, Jack Vance. Stay tuned. Again, good morning. So, yeah, fundraising drive, 4 preemptions in a row. I was responsible for one of the preemptions. I could have been here last week, midnight to 3 a.m., but I wasn't actually aware of it. A memo went out saying that Jim Freund would be on, you know, covering Robert Knight in his own show, but I never got the memo. And, you know, I mean, it's the old joke. He never got the memo, and that's exactly what happened. I did talk to a power that be at about, 6:30 or so about it, and I could have come in, but at that point, I was just not in the right frame of mind. And you have to understand that last week we were still, and we still are, reeling in our heads with the death of 3 members of our WBAI family. The couple that did lifestyle program on Monday afternoons, and Ibrahim Gonzalez. I didn't know that couple very well. I do know that they were, that the writing up of what happened to them was pretty horrid. And really, it was a teasing, snarky, nasty piece of journalism, in my opinion. I have to say that because I'm not libeling or slandering. I am simply saying how I felt upon reading that piece. And Ibrahim, who I have worked with, who liked to read stories on the air, we had a certain amount in common. So last week was just a karmically crappy week, and I was advised after a conversation, told that I could do a three-hour show. We talked about it rationally and all that, and decided, you know what, Jim, it's better that you, you know, come in next week when the pitching will be over, and, you know, be refreshed. And I would like that to be the case, only the pitching, at least for the daytime, isn't over. People are really, really, you know, taking a look at social media going, what? TF? And, which means transmitter fund. You can't blame them, but at the same time, we have seen the numbers in memos to the staff. And the bad news is that they had to extend this fundraising drive 4 days. The good news is that, it, you know, it sounds like we're going to be getting a new home, a place that we're going to buy, purchase. And my heart still lives with the church. A quick story about, you know, as I'm going down memory lane. During this last month, when I haven't been on the air, I recorded any number of interviews, including a brilliant, wonderful writer whose work sort of comes from the mainstream but crosses into the genre area, by the name of Moira Crone, C-R-O-N-E, who's very New Orleans-oriented, as is her fiction. And we're going to hear that very soon. And Tom Doyle from Washington. And then at BEA last week, at the Book Expo of America, I attended a party thrown by Bain Books for Steve Miller and Sharon Lee, who I've corresponded with over the years but never actually met. They write the very, very popular Pop-U-Lar Liaden books. And we were getting along. I recorded in their hotel room, and I said, oh, well, let me tell you how I got the show. I got the show because Margot Adler, by the way, whose new book all about the current vampire fanaticism in fiction and her own experience with it, came out yesterday on Amazon as an Amazon single. And as Margot wrote in her email to me announcing it, it's cheaper than an ice cream cone, which is true. And to find out more, go to margotadler.com, and margotadler.com. It's not a big website. It took me about 10 minutes to build it. We're going to make it a good one, however. Anyway, so I mentioned that, and I mentioned that there was a point where Margot went to Clarion. I tell this story all the time, and I took over Hour of the Wolf from her. And that this was in 1974. And Steve Miller contradicts me. He said, no, it was 1973. Excuse me? It was 1973. Margot and I worked together. Let me tell you all the other people. And he had all this information. So apparently I've been doing this show a year longer than I thought, making this approximately, actually it would be next month, would be the 40th anniversary of my taking over the reins of Howard the Wolf from Margot. And I didn't even know it. Sigh.